Yes.
Okay. Section 41, excuse me, page 41 of the bill. Section 101, again, where this is a change made to the rule relating to departures. It clarifies some language and is a good improvement. We're suggesting, again, that rather than amending the rule, you direct the board to do so. And the clarifying language is at lines 40 and 41. It has to do with how you would calculate persistent involvement in similar offenses. We want to make it clear that when a consecutive sentence is being imposed, that that behavior has to relate to something other than those cases being sentenced consecutively.
Okay.
At page 45 of the bill, section 106 was in your original version.
This section, it only is a technical amendment that did appear in your original bill. They just moved, LC just moved it to this position in the bill because of the other changes.
It eliminated, I believe, a reference to temporary leave.
Yes.
Then, the next thing that I want to point out to you is on page 58. The emergency clause needs to be renumbered, and then you have before you some additional new language, which would be a final new section to the bill.
B-19?
It's called, yeah, it's called Future Enhancements B-19. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What this language provides is that in the future, if there are correctional resources beyond those that are necessary for these guidelines to be implemented, and that's the additional 1,200 beds beyond the 500-bed medium prison, that if there are available correctional resources beyond that figure and beyond whatever you all determine is a reasonable margin of resources for management purposes, that when the board adopts guidelines and increases sentences, it should give priority to these three kinds of offenses. The House took this language from the capacity report of the council, saying that these were three areas that should be emphasized if sentences are to be enhanced in any section of the guidelines. Subsection A is drug offenses. Subsection B is penalties for post-prison violations. Subsection C is an increase in penalties for violent crimes. The second page of this new language at subsection 2 says that in the next legislative session, we will bring you projections, the council will submit to you projections of additional resources needed to implement the guidelines themselves as they are adopted by this legislative session. Recommendations for financing, if that's your desire. Recommendations for amendments that would increase the sanctions if we're in a position where that's possible, and projections about the need for beds with those increases.
Madam Chair.
Senator Schumaker.
Question regarding the B-19 amendments. The three categories that are to be given priority over other categories, are those three of equal priority, or does A have higher priority over B and B over C?
The when the board made this recommendation, they did rank them in a hierarchy, that A was the most important,
and
B the next, C the third.
Well, I think that this
leaves it up to the
board. Statute ought to be clear, though, whether this is a descending order of priority or whether these three have equal priority but are ahead of all others. It seems to me that we ought to be
Senator
clear.
Senator, they're going to come into the legislative session to do that anyway, or get approval of those. Okay?
Yes, but I think it would be well if they had guidance so that when they came in, it would have the chances are that you approve what they come in with, but if they come in and they're, what they've done is
we
on
have,
the wrong premise, then
fine,
we have a problem.
LC draft. Got, we do have an LC draft. Okay.
Well, I assume it's the same as this. So.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hill.
The 19, the B-19 amendments, the B-18, and the ones described as SB-1073-C, are those all within the LC-2250-3 amendments?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, yes, they are.
There are. Where do we find them? In?
Those are sections 91, 94, and then the new section should be.
Well, I don't want to take a lot of time. It's, if it's intended that these themselves are in descending order of priority, I think it's simple enough to simply say so.
Well, I think we ought to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think that's fine.
Okay.
Okay, let's, Jack, are we...
The only thing, as I understand it, that's not included in the LC draft is a modification to the Attorney General's amendment. And the Attorney General's amendment is in the draft.
Okay.
And the modification I'll hand out to you right now.
Let's hear from the Attorney General. Kathleen, do you have anything else to say?
Is here.
I found one of the sections. Section 135 happens to be B-19.
Okay, well, I think we have a legislative record on what that is.
Okay.
And Senator Shoemaker has, I don't hear any dissent on that. Okay, Dale and who else is here? Okay, Dale, do you want to come and talk to us about the Attorney General's opinions?
Yes. My name is Dale Penn from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Virginia Linder, who testified before you about the whole amendment, had to go back to her office. She should be back in a minute. This, I believe that the amendments she proposed to you this afternoon are included in the LC draft, as I understand
yes.
it. There is one additional change, though, and I believe this has been passed out to you, that in continuing to work on this while you were in session, we believe this language is clearer. It's very important under the Constitution and under the present statutory framework that
okay.
you develop.
I want to stop you, Dale, yeah. and see that we find ourselves really in the in section 106. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
106
it's
of the
very
of the,
end of the
LC.
Yes, I don't have a copy of the LC amendment, so I. Can't refer to those.
Could you give it?
The only additional change we would be proposing is this change that...
No, it's 198.
Page 78.
Yeah.
Page 78.
Okay. Thank you very much. It relates to the wording of the fourth question on a death penalty case, and we would be adding a subparagraph D. This is in
page 78. And it's actually a substitution, isn't it?
Yes, it's simply deleting lines 8 through 11 and adding a new paragraph D. And that's what this amendment would do. And it's just a change in wording. It starts out the same if constitutionally required. The wording becomes different, however, and it ends up, it's the same meaning, but it must have an affirmative answer for the death penalty. And we were concerned that the wording was going to get very confusing. You'll see that the last phrase is, should a sentence of death be imposed? That is the precise question that the jury will be given, taking into account the defendant's character, the defendant's background, the circumstances of the offense, to bring in this fourth question and the mitigating circumstances and whether or not those circumstances would reduce the defendant's moral culpability, given all of that, should the defendant receive the death penalty. And if the jury would say yes to this question unanimously, then along with yes to the first three questions, then the death sentence would be imposed. If there's an answer no to those other three or this fourth one, then the death penalty would not be imposed. But this is just a change to substitute paragraph D. We believe this would be a clearer statement, and it would put an affirmative answer for the death penalty, a negative answer to negate the death penalty.
Dale, I have a question for you. I want to make sure for the record that what we're doing here is substituting the subparagraph D.
Yes.
And that you are still wishing for us to include the sub C, small c, on page 78 that's included here.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure and absolutely clear that we don't delete something that is unintended here.
Right.
We are going, you're requesting that we substitute language for the D, sub C.
Sub C would stay the same. From the LC draft, we would ask that you delete lines 8 through 11. That's that subparagraph D, and insert this paragraph D, which we have as a single amendment.
That is submitted by the Department of Justice June 29, 1989.
Yes.
Senator Shoemaker.
Madam Chair, I have no problem with the concept, but as I read this thing, it just doesn't parse to me.
Well, that comes from the U.S. Supreme Court cases, and they are directing it. They are reciting them directly,
But the phraseology, I mean, how do you ask a jury this? Just considering the extent to which the defendant's character and background and the circumstances of the offense may reduce the defendant's moral culpability or blameworthiness for the crime, should a sentence of death be imposed?
Well, I want to tell you that the people that we had testimony this morning from the Attorney General and all of his solicitors, that they have reviewed the U.S. Supreme Court cases. They're in the business of reviewing all the death penalty cases, and they have talked to the practicing people who do these death penalty cases. I am certainly not willing to touch, this is one thing that I'm not willing to touch a word of, frankly,
right.
Senator Shoemaker, just for the sake of English. Because
being understandable.
Well, I think it's, and I would ask Mr. Penn to comment.
Okay. What does Linder do here?
I agree. It's confusing language, and yet I believe it is correct, and it is correct according to the Penway case. And it just, if Constitution required, that's going to be a judicial decision. The issue is going to be: should a sentence of death be imposed, considering the extent to which the defendant's character and background and the circumstances of the offense may reduce the defendant's moral culpability or blameworthiness for the crime? Then the issue is, should the death sentence be imposed? That allows all the mitigating circumstances to be in there, all kinds of arguments by the state and the defense, both for or against death, whether or not the other three questions are relevant. And that's the intent of the Supreme Court's opinion.
Right.
Okay. Yes, I do believe that one thing. This is not one that we have.
Not when we're going to pull it.
Yes.
Madam Chair, then I would move that the language just described and that is contained on the document described and submitted by the Department of Justice, June 29, 1989, House Bill 2250, be substituted for the language on page 78 of the House Bill 2250-3 amendments, that this language be substituted for lines 8 through 11 and described as section D on page 78, that language be substituted for that.
Are there objections to that amendment? Hearing none, so
okay. Chair, don't we need to take this language and insert it into House Bill 2250?
This would be to move these amendments. Well,
it's moving to amend the language that's in here, but okay. This, what's in here, hasn't been moved into House Bill 2250.
Now he's going to move.
Now he's going to move.
I'm going to move this whole.
Okay, I just didn't know We could do it that way, okay.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, then I would move the House Bill 2250-3 amendments.
Okay, as amended by Senator Hill's previous accepted motion. Are there discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 22-50 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Now, let's get on to the gun bill.
Madam Chair, be...
30, what are we?
3470.
Right. 3470.
Just a question in passing. Have we, as Jack, I guess, looked at the bill that passed before this morning regarding the true life
yes,
bill as it relates to this?
Yes, we have. That's been checked out. There was discussion about amending the true life bill, and we decided, no, we should do it in here.
Okay, but this, once you get this into the descending order
right.
question, it fits the other
fits
bill.
Right in there. Great. That's what it is, yes. That's the purpose. Okay. We have people signed up on 3470, and we have some conference committees in about 15 minutes. Springer, you...
Have the excuse for conference committee.
Yes, but we want you to come back for discussion on Section 38
okay.
of the gun bill. I know you have an interest.
Right. Okay, I'll be back as soon as I can.
Okay, thank
is
you.
Is that one I'm on with him?
Are you both on that? What is it?
Is this 52?
No, it's a not. Okay.
I've got a couple coming up my shelf.
Yeah, let's get on with... We left off with 3470 with a discussion really on Section 36, I guess, the mental health people. We're going to come and tell us, I don't know if Corey's here to talk about Section 36 again. Corey's been here. Okay, and we had the city people who wanted to make sure there was an amendment. We don't have any city people here now, okay.
I know where that is.
Yeah. Thanks. Go ahead. We want to spend a little time with Section 36.
Section 36 is a civil commitment statutes. We've added that the judge will make an order regarding firearm purchase and possessing. This has evolved. This has evolved after much discussion about people just being committed for to be prohibited. We felt, and the subcommittee felt on the House side that it would be better that the person who had the information in front of them and heard the situation would be in the best position to make the determination about firearm ownership and the right to purchase a firearm.
Okay, Corey. Now, my concern with this is that are there any directions to the judge about how the person, do we need to do anything to clarify, or is that perfectly clear that what the judge is going to be doing, or how he's going to arrive at that decision?
The wording is, as a result of the person's mental or psychological state, et cetera, on the lines 11 through 14.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that language is also language that appears in part in Senate Bill 412, which is a reporting
okay,
statute.
Good.
And what
okay.
we have tried to do is tie as much as possible to develop an objective standard and one that is consistent throughout. And it seems to me that some of that language, as we were working it together with the various interested parties, that the same language is being used and it will come up similar or comparable from 412.
Okay, and then you're satisfied that that's, well, I guess the committee members didn't really, but your folks were satisfied that this was enough direction to the judge to make a decision. Jack, you have any other questions about that?
No.
What happens, just for curiosity's sake, if 412 doesn't pass? I mean, can this function by itself? You still have a list, you still have a duty to report. This won't work at all? I mean, admittedly, it won't be quite as broad, but we need to know what that means.
There will be two lists. If 412 does not pass, the lists of the reports made under 412 would disappear.
Right.
This list, the civil commitment list, stands by itself.
Right.
So you're going to end up with not only a parallel list, two different kinds of lists coming from two separate places. So 412 has one list. What's in this section is a separate list. It's a civil commitment list.
Okay, yeah. I just needed to make sure that it didn't foul up the entire thing. It just takes a piece of it away.
That's correct. There are two separate lists involving persons with mental illness.
Okay. Any other thing we need to understand about this section? No, I didn't call for Bradbury for anything. I thought it was only members who didn't know where we were this time of the session. There's no use to have, there's no excuse to have staff feel any better, right? But you should find the right place for wherever they're asking for Bradbury. Okay. Then I guess that, you know, I guess that's that you have fixed that up pretty well to the extent that people are satisfied.
I think there's a three-part answer. First of all, the new language that's being added to the civil commitment says that specifically the prohibition is necessary. So there's a tie-in there. There was also a sort of a consent. So that was the first part. The second part is that there was an attempt to make it based on past patterns of behavior or participation in incidences as opposed to predicting future dangerousness. We really stayed away from that whole concept of predicting future dangerousness, and we took care of that. We tried to. And third, there was a lot of work put into coming up with language by all the interested parties, I think, on the representing very diverse views of how you get at this. And I think everyone to agree that this was, given those two things, the best way to begin to deal with the issue.
I want to call up the person from the Mental Health Division. Larry's been here for all, watching patients. I want to have you get something for your pay. You better come up and make a comment about how the agencies think this is going to be able to work. And we just want it for the record. And then while you're thinking about that, we need to talk about the effective date so we can get some drafting instructions back for Senator Shoemaker and whoever's going to, and Jack and whoever else is going to work on this task.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, Lawrence Young with the Attorney General's Office. I am not here to present the agency position. I was asked to be a member of the task force team because there was a question when the bill was originally drafted, the desire was to require all psychologists and psychiatrists to report those people that they thought were dangerous to self or others so that they could be placed on the health division list. And I got involved in the bill that way, and I've been the Attorney General's representative throughout the process. I have not been, nor do I purport to be, representing the Mental Health Division at this point.
Okay, but so you're just a participant on the
technical part of the work. I am part of the working committee.
Okay. Do we have a discussion on what we think anybody might want to choose for an effective date?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to note, and I'm sure Jack will pick this up, there is, in terms of the mental commitment sections, we did bifurcate the system for those persons that had been previously committed and those that would be committed under the new provisions of this act, so that will have to be conformed to whatever date that goes into effect, so that's changed as well.
And I haven't read it. Is that, how long do they, is there a way to get out of this? Let's assume I've got civilly committed myself in a fit of depression because I lost a daughter or a son, and then there's nothing, once I've recovered from that and I'm like any other ordinary person. Tell me how I can get rid of, how I can go back to get a gun again.
Through the court review process.
Okay, so I would have to file in court to go back to do that?
That's correct.
Madam Chairperson, if I may interject at this point, if you commit yourself from the date of the effective date of the bill on, you would not be barred from having a handgun or any other sort of firearm under this particular bill, because the requirements for the bill state that there has to be a civil commitment proceeding, which implies that it is involuntary. Involuntary court proceeding, the person to be committed doesn't want to be committed, and the judge would have to make a finding at that point that the person, the alleged mentally ill person, could not or was not in a position to own or purchase a firearm. There is a provision in the bill that provides, I think, if you've been committed within the last 6 years, that's a rolling provision. If you wanted to get out of the disability created under that, either time would go by or you could ask for relief under the relief section of the particular bill. If you had been committed, voluntarily committed prior to that time, it would not operate as a bar to possessing firearms, this bill. I'm sorry, it's not a rolling. If you've been committed within the last 6 years, you would have to go for relief. If you were committed sometime prior to the 6 years prior to the effective date of this bill would not affect you.
Okay.
And I think under...
The quick. Do you have a comment?
I have a question about how 412 ended up being. And I think that if you commit yourself, if you voluntarily commit yourself, you would not end up on a 412 list either. But that's... I was looking for Diana for... You would not. So I just wanted, in order to make sure you have an accurate answer,
yeah,
if you commit yourself under 412...
Who are of the quotes tagged mentally ill or people with mental problems, who are going to bring into this net in terms of non-gun use?
As Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Larry has said, I mean, if you take this a year down the road, at that point it will be those persons who have been civilly committed by the court, and this particular finding made, or those persons who, because they pose a present danger under the provisions of 412, and I don't know what the exact words are, would be on that mental health list. There also is within the current version of 412, which I understand is in conference committee, some alternatives opened up to the reporting psychotherapist to give them options besides reporting to the police, like referring to commitment, which has also made that net, that potential net, I think, even smaller. I think we added in one other option, I think, and so...
Yeah, I think it's important that you have some finding, in as many cases as possible, some finding of dangerousness associated with just an indiscriminate.
But that is what I think the intent of doing the civil commitment statutes, changing the civil commitment statutes was to get at that issue exactly. And then in terms of narrowing 412 and giving other options so that a person... would not end up on that list inappropriately.
Excuse me. Yeah, but it's already gone, then we can make it at the desk if we need to. Excuse me, we have a problem with one of the little conference committee bills, which you may be familiar with. An error in an amendment, or a typo, or something.
Oh. Okay.
Typos always get in people.
Technical amendments.
Okay, any other questions on this matter? Jack?
I have heard, I don't know, is it true that because Damish is refusing to take people on voluntary commitments because there's no room, that people are sometimes going the civil commitment route instead as an alternative to a voluntary commitment?
Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, as the Attorney General that provides legal services to Damish State Hospital, I have heard the same thing. I do not know if that is in fact true. The people that would usually be responsible for that kind of commitment, if you do not do a voluntary commitment, would be the district attorneys.
I'd like to go ahead and move to Section 38, if anyone else. I know that Senator Springer has questions. I might want to send for him, ask him to come up out of his conference committee if he can to discuss Section 38. He's in a conference committee someplace, I'm not sure where. Section 38, Jack, or Core, is a preemption language?
Yes.
Okay.
And this language has come about from many discussions. There's some case law that I'm not an expert on, or pretend to be, a Dollar Hyde case. It has to do with cities enacting ordinances stricter than state ordinances, especially in related to criminal penalties. The whole idea is that a local city or political subdivision would try to ban firearms or do something to that effect. The gun lobby, you know, is opposed to that, and this was an attempt to state case law and still allow the cities to regulate for public safety reasons in areas they'd have a legitimate concern to do so.
Okay, and the local jurisdictions have, this doesn't get in the way of our, lo and behold, our 3400, Senate Bill 3400 and our Senate Bill 2282 and all the efforts they've done to try to say nothing we do up here.
Right.
Except as otherwise provided by law, we believe would cover that. Virginia Vanderbilt is here, and she has may also be able to speak to this.
Right. Why don't we have Virginia come forward if she's here? If she's not here, Jack will just deal with her comments.
I have a letter from Virginia Vanderbilt that I believe you have, but I can read it at any rate.
Well, I don't think, you can read one piece of it if you want.
I don't know if the discussion with the City of Portland folks touched on this, but let me make sure I understand this correctly. If a person gets a concealed weapon permit, I assume that it's within Portland, which does have a prohibition against carrying a loaded firearm, you know, under any circumstances, I assume, public or private, as I understand the ordinance. Basically, if a person had a concealed weapon permit, they could carry a loaded firearm. Okay. Or carry a concealed weapon about their person. I mean, the concern I have is, you know, the cops say that half the cars in North and Northeast Portland, who knows, maybe Southeast Portland, have got a gun under the front seat or in the jockey box. I mean, it's just kind of, unfortunately, a fact of life. And I'm just trying to learn if a person has a concealed weapon permit, whether carrying a loaded gun under the front seat or in the glove box is going to be permitted, notwithstanding Oregon law. Or, pardon me, the City of Portland ordinance.
So long as it complies with the provisions of the new provisions in this act, and again, I mean, unfortunately, you know, Madam Chair and Senator Springer, as you well know, I mean, there are no, this is very gray. I think that the overall intent was to be consistent with what the courts have decided and not upset the status quo which people were living with, were upset it to the least amount possible. To address that particular issue, there is a part of the bill now that talks about guns and vehicles and that kind of stuff, and I think that those would override.
My sense is, you know, I'm coming from officer safety, and I mean, I it's not the movies where I've seen the officers say, you got a gun in there, or they see something they think is a gun. It's everybody's out of the car. They're not asking if you've got a, you know, a little thing with your picture on it. They don't usually stop for that, and I don't think they're going to stop for that either if they think there's a gun in the vehicle. And if I were in their position, I'd be doing the same thing.
Okay. What is the provision regarding vehicles?
Page 17, lines 7 and 8.
No, that's, I guess.
Senator Springer and I are going to go off to the Jackson Conference Committee.
Kath will be here.
There's Jack, Senator Hill's going to take some people who've signed up to give us their comments and their impressions. And then.
If I read this correctly, then, if a person has a general concealed weapon permit, which is statute not specific about where you may conceal it, you simply may have a concealed weapon, you may have that on your person or in your vehicle or wherever.
Has to be readily accessible.
Huh?
Has to be, or not readily. Am I reading this backwards?
Yeah. Carries concealed and readily accessible about the person within any vehicle. So a city then that would require a permit that is vehicle specific, for instance, would be out of line. They couldn't do that.
Correct. Vehicle specific?
I'll say yes. You may carry this weapon in this vehicle. Or something of that sort.
I think that would be problematic.
Your vehicle.
Right.
I don't know what they do require, what their limitations are. They couldn't do that.
Anything else, Senator Schumer? But what I'd like to do then is let you all, thank you all very much. And I think there's some people, if there's someone else who would like to testify on the bill, let me just give you the time frames. I have a conference committee at 6:30, so just want to let you know what it is. And anyone else who would like to testify, please come up and give your name.
3470?
Yes. If you all would like to come up together, that'll be fine.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Stephen Donnell. I'm testifying for the pro-gun civil rights lobby. I will hand the secretary petitions that have approximately 600 signatures. They're gathered by people in mercantile establishments throughout the states by the West Coast Arms Collectors. We've been discussing Section 38. My understanding that this actually is not
record. That'll be part of the record for that.
Not a preemption statute. It's actually enabling legislation. And in Lodi and Roten versus Portland, which was in January, they specifically pointed out that only those laws that are covered under state statutes are preempted. And so what happens under Section 38 in this particular case is you have enabled the local jurisdiction to pass any type of regulation that they wish for the possession of firearms. Now, in Eastern Oregon, where I come from, this is very, very critical. The average rancher out there goes around with his rifle and his shotgun in his vehicle, and generally they are loaded in the magazine, very rarely in the chamber, and they use them for predator control and that type of thing. And if Section 38 goes through as effectuated presently in the bill, every little town and every city and every county in Eastern Oregon or across the state of Oregon can pass their own ordinances affecting the possession of that firearm in their vehicle on a public road. Furthermore, for instance, in Portland, the way it is set up, they could effectively say that you could not have a firearm in possession in a public place for the purpose of a sale. And the rationale would simply be is that the black market for firearms basically takes place in taverns, public parking lots, and back alleys. That then provision could be carried over, and they add one exclusion to that and say unless you have a dealer's license. That then would effectively shut down the gun shows, because then unless you had a dealer's license, you could not have a firearm in a gun show or a swap meet or whatever for sale. So we're very concerned about Section 38. We're concerned about other parts of the bill, and yesterday I had the secretary pass out to you copies of the material that we were concerned about, and we have indicated that if most of those provisions were cleaned up and the areas that we're concerned about, we would take another look at the bill. The difficulty with this bill is that it says a lot of things, but when we go ahead and research what they actually mean, which has been brought out in the committee testimony, we get something different. Testimony has been given that this bill does not affect the private sale between people, but when you get over into the area of sales, and it says intentionally, all sales are intentional. There's no relief for the individual.
So what section are you on? I'm sorry. I think it'll help me in at least if we're being specific, and I can look at the language while we're talking about it.
And you're referring to your, this is by Oregon Program Civil Rights Lobby.
That is the material that we supplied, yes, sir. Get over here in the section. Page 9, Section 3, and it says, unless relief has been granted under Section 11 of this 1989 Act.
Now you're talking from the printed bill now.
Yes, I'm talking from the printed bill, yes, sir. No person shall intentionally sell, deliver, otherwise transfer any firearm to any person. And then they use the word who. We're suggesting that whom the person knows, as shown on your sheet, who knows is. The reason for that is that very simply, there's no protection for the person who doesn't know his friend has had two DUILs or a couple misdemeanor convictions which would preclude him from having a firearm. And then if something happens, he can be arrested and convicted under this act and charged with a Class C felony. That's a very great concern of ours. Another concern of ours is the fact that...
Senator Schumacher.
Let me interrupt. I think the meaning of intentionally there is not... It doesn't modify sell. I think it modifies to any person who is under 18 years of age and so forth.
Yes.
In other words, I think that the intent has to be to sell to a person who you know fits one of these categories.
We have checked this with a couple of attorneys that are working with us, and they are also concerned. And the reason we bring this up is that the present language says whom the person has cause to believe, and they feel that to make this crystal clear and very effective from the standpoint of so there's no ambiguity in the intent of this section, that if you add whom the person knows is, then that would take care of a gross concern that we have. On the bill. Another area of the bill is the fact that the city of Portland is concerned about the fact that if you are a police officer or someone like that and you are effectuating issuance of the sales permit, authorizing sale, that they are not protected from civil liability if something happens and they've made a mistake. We feel that that protection should also go to the dealers who act in good faith underneath the information from the police. That particular section is not in the amendments that we proposed to you. We feel that should be extended to the...
Where are you? I'm sorry.
Okay.
I've lost you again. You're going to have to tell me where you are.
Okay. Where we are is in the section on selling, which is the same section you are in now. To Section 3, and we have in here the fact that the Section 3 and then they also the other sections that deal with exactly the same thing, we have the fact that when you are going to sell a firearm and you act in good faith on the information supplied by the police, you don't have any protection against tort action or civil liability.
Okay.
And the city of Portland brought up the same point. I think you have a letter to that effect in your file up there about that they want the same protection on anyone who works in the police agencies.
Are you with us, Jack? Do you understand the point?
Pardon me?
Do you understand the point that he's making?
Are you suggesting there needs to be a requirement of knowledge that on the part of the person selling who that person he's selling to is under a disability?
There's two classes of people to sell: those that are private people, which we addressed earlier about knows is. Then there is a second class of people who are the licensed dealer who are in the business of actually selling firearms all the time.
Right.
And the way this bill is written right now, they must receive relief 15 days on all concealable firearms, handguns in this case, before they can transfer. Well, let's assume that the police make a mistake and the person is prohibited from having the firearm and the dealer acts in good faith on the police information. and then the person that has bought the firearm from the dealer goes out the next week and commits a crime with it. The person who has been the victim of the crime could bring action against the dealer, and that's being done around the country right now. For instance, they're trying to say that the firearms are inherently dangerous, and therefore the manufacturer is selling an inherently dangerous product. And
are we talking about Section 3?
Yes, on sales.
Right. Okay, this doesn't have anything to do with civil liability, so I guess I'm not following you on that. But this section was discussed yesterday, and the representatives stated that it was their intent that the word intentionally, and it's not drafted very well, but that there is a requirement that the person, before he can get in trouble for selling to somebody, actually knew that that person was under a disability.
And all we're asking is that be further clarifying by putting in whom the person knows is.
Okay.
That's all we're asking for, which is basically the same language that's in present law.
Now, your second point somewhat has to do with it. If a dealer sells to a person under a disability.
Yes. Because, and he didn't do it intentionally, because the police who cleared that person to buy the firearm said there's no prohibition for that person to buy.
All right. But it turns out the person is under a disability.
Yes, sir.
And commits a crime.
Yes.
And so the victim then sues the dealer.
Yes.
And the dealer's defense is, well, I didn't violate Section 3.
That's true.
I didn't violate Section 3, so you can't pin liability on me for violating the act.
Well, that's also correct.
What's the problem?
That's also correct, but the thing that we're concerned about is that if the police are held free and the other people who are issuing the permits are held released from any civil liability, we feel that the dealer should be also. That's what we're saying.
Well, he would be, as I understand.
I think we can. I don't want to belabor these points. Yeah. We'd like to move. There are other people who want to testify, and we've got to be done by 6:30. So,
It's the same concept the city of Portland's asked for in the bill, which you have in your letter, as I understand it. I talked this over with the city lobbyist from Portland. She said they're concerned about the same thing, and you have a letter to that effect. I understand.
Okay. Well, and we also hear. We'll check it out, and I think Senator Shoemaker believes that it's already covered without it being explicit, but we'll check it.
There have been a number of things said about the bill.
Okay.
One of them is that this does not allow for central registration of firearm sales. Basically, that's partially correct. What you have in the bill is a situation that the bill specifically says that no division of state government can maintain no central register. That does not preclude home rule counties and general law counties and cities from putting in their own registration, and then the association of counties and or sheriffs to access that particular file from a central computer. And we're concerned about that also.
They could do that now, I assume, if they choose to.
Yes, they could. That is correct.
So
that is correct.
Dealing with that issue.
And then there is one other aspect of the bill. It says that the records only must be destroyed during the one-year period of the study, and after that, the bill is silent. And since the same basic procedures are going on after the study is over with, then the central registration could start. There's been discussion that antiques are exempt from the bill. That's partially correct. Section 16, which is sale of all firearms to dealers by individuals, is specifically exempted from the antique exception in Section 25, page 20 to line 25. And so we have a situation there of where they are correct when they say that purchase of antiques by people are exempt, but when a dealer buys an antique, that is not exempt.
Okay, I think
we have other things, but the committee has time. I guess what we're saying is that we feel that the bill as presently drawn does not do what the supporters of the bill have said that it does, and we are concerned, and we feel that...
Okay, we do appreciate that. We're here to sort of look at technical amendments and try to get the bill streamlined, and that's where we're... Appreciate your concerns, and we'll look over some of the things and see what you have and see what people think about them, but thanks.
Madam Chairman, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bob Bell, and then I want to hear from John McCulley on the record before we go to make sure we have your concerns. And Bob, appreciate you sort of coming up here and hanging around with us as difficult it is this late in session.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Bell, and Madam Chairman, I'm speaking for the Albany Rifle and Pistol Club, and I gave letters to your staff there, and basically the letter states that the Albany Rifle and Pistol Club supports House Bill 3470 being engrossed, and also in there it lists some of the senators that are in, we have members in these districts, and it's basically in support of the bill as it is written now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Mr. McCulley.
Madam Chair, John McCulley, representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. I'm going to comment primarily on two sections of the bill that you'll find on pages 10 and 11. Which are sections 3 and sections 5. I've also had distributed to the committee a letter from Dr. Joseph Bloom regarding this bill. In his letter, he refers to sections 2 and 4, but the content of the sections he addresses in there are contained in the be-engrossed version of sections 3 and 5. And I will try to summarize his comments and provide our concerns to you about these two sections of the bill. Before I get specifically into those, I would like to express the our appreciation to the attention that the Speaker's office and the House committee paid to our concerns. As this bill was originally drafted, we were very worried about the provisions in the bill. We worked with the Speaker's office and the committee to try to address those concerns. They met them partially. And had this not been such a major policy issue for us, we probably would have said, thank you very much, we will live with what you have done, and walked away. But this is a very central issue, we believe, related to the stigmatization of the mentally ill, and in Section 5, the creation of a mental health register that would be used for the purposes of this act. The prohibited persons list in Section 3 on page 10 addresses several instances when those who are mentally ill would be included as those prohibited from purchasing or possessing a firearm. The issue I would like to speak to is primarily on lines 10 and 11, those who have been committed to the mental health division under the civil commitment statutes within the last 6 years. We offered the language that was adopted by the House committee that in future civil commitments, the judge would make a determination based on the evidence of whether or not the person should possess a firearm. We believe that to cast a net saying that all those who are civilly committed should therefore be considered dangerous and not be able to purchase or possess a firearm. There are a number of circumstances that lead to civil commitment. Not the least of which in this state, unfortunately, is the fact that Damish State Hospital has been closed to voluntary admissions for a number of years. And because of resource issues, those who could have gone voluntarily into the state hospital have had to deteriorate to the point where they are involuntarily committed now. So in some ways, the state has contributed to the fact that people may be on this prohibited persons list. If the committee would not see fit to delete that section, we would at least request that the time that is in their 6 years be reduced to 4 years, so that persons who are poor and mentally ill and have been civilly committed are not prohibited any longer from having purchasing or possessing a firearm than those who have actually committed a crime. And we think that, at least from an equity standpoint, that would be a move that should be made. Speaking to Section 5 of the bill, which is found on page 11, this is the part of the bill that ties the creation of a registry to those who are reported under Senate Bill 412, which has been before this committee, passed the Senate, has passed the House, and is now in conference committee. Just briefly under that bill, the bill creates an affirmative duty for a psychotherapist to warn a potential victim if there is a specific threat against that victim and the psychotherapist believes that the threat will be carried out. The duty is discharged by the psychotherapist by warning the victim, warning the police, or, as the House added, taking steps for civil commitment. Under Senate or House Bill 3470, Section 5, if the police are warned that the name, address, date of birth, sex of the patient would be forwarded to the Health Division and be placed on a registry. The concerns we have are, number one, the creation of a registry. We think that this is a very major policy when you are establishing a registry of people. And the other concern we have, based on some very, very subjective judgments. The psychotherapists who will come under Senate Bill 412 number in the hundreds. They include counselors who will now be licensed under the provisions of Senate Bill 698, just passed this session. They include, of course, psychologists, psychiatrists, clinical social workers, nurses, a wide variety of people with a wide variety of experiences and abilities. There, in the literature, there is no way to predict dangerousness. The dangerousness can be predicted on a short-term basis, but attempts to predict dangerousness, the studies show a psychotherapist does not have that ability. So what is being done here is the creation of a registry based on, like I say, very subjective views of psychotherapists. The same patient may be reported by one psychotherapist and not reported by another psychotherapist, and the patient would be exhibiting the same actions or reactions to a situation. We think that this is of grave concern. The issue of protecting the public, we believe, is carried out under Section 3 in the prohibited persons list. We do not think that you are going to gain a great deal by creating this registry based on the subjective data that I have discussed. We think that the public will be protected by the objective data, at least the more objective data, that is used to create the prohibited persons list through the civil commitment process. As a result, we would request that the committee delete Section 5 of the bill and rely on Section 3 as the way, if there is a concern about those who are mentally ill and the very small, dangerous segment of that population, to use Section 3 as the basis for controlling that group of people. I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions you have.
Thank you. Diana.
Ms. Godwin wanted me to point out that as a result of this part of the bill, our organization is now in opposition to Senate Bill 412. We have been trying for several sessions to pass that bill because we think it's important. But we think this issue is much larger than the Senate Bill 412. If this section were deleted, we would be in support of Senate Bill 412 once again.
Here. Seems to me that to have the following chain of events. You have a patient and he makes a threat toward somebody, which you as a psychiatrist or psychologist take seriously, and acting under 412, notify the victim. Don't seek immediate civil commitment of that patient. You might, but you choose not to. And he leaves.
It's for sure tomorrow.
He now goes and, fulfilling that threat, buys a weapon.
Yeah, I just got one more question, actually.
And if that report is then put on a computer somewhere, and the place that, to which he goes to buy the weapon then learns that this person has made a threat, they can block the sale of the weapon. But if they don't know that, you don't have time, and it's not the situation where you're going to be, anybody's going to be taking this person before a court to have him declared unsafe to have a firearm, because it hasn't progressed to that point. But here you've got a guy who's made a threat, and now he's proceeding to carry it out. Isn't that exactly the person we want to catch somehow?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, we believe that the person who may be in that position has probably in the past exhibited violence. And is
necessarily. Anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
And we believe that they would be more than likely, and we can argue that, I suppose, but more than likely covered under the prohibited persons list, either as a violent misdemeanant or someone else who has been through the civil commitment process. In addition, one of the reasons that we wanted to seek civil commitment in Senate Bill 412 was to give the psychotherapist every opportunity to maintain the therapeutic relationship with the patient, believing that that was the best protection, that once that therapeutic relationship was broken, that protection of the potential victim was lessened. We think that notification of the police, if that became the last resort, would offer the protection.
How would it?
The Senator Shoemaker, the person's name, address, the threat that was made, the intended victim, all of that information would be provided to the police, as well as information as to the person's frame of mind, what